Group meeting, Saturday, 21st May, 1988. We have come practically to the end of the chapter on the teachers of the Upanishads. But there is one very interesting Upanishad, the Katha Upanishad. Katha means a tale. In which a Brahman is giving away his goods and all his possessions before he becomes a roving mendicant in the forest. And his son, whose name is Nachiketas, which means, the name means not knowing, unknowing. His son Nachiketas says to his father, "To whom will you give me?" And the father doesn't reply. He asks him a second time and a third time. And then Papa, becoming a little bit impatient, says, "To death I give you, Yamaraja, the Lord of Death." Now, the originality of the form in which the divine dialogue is presented in this Katha Upanishad throws a revealing light on the nature of such dialogue. Nachiketas, therefore, goes to the home of the Lord of Death. Now, it is extremely interesting indeed. Nachiketas doesn't die. He is not killed as a sacrifice on the sacrificial altar or any such thing. He goes to the home of the Lord of Death. What can it mean? I can only see one proper meaning to it. The writer of the Katha Upanishad himself, entering the state of holistic consciousness, which is the consciousness of infinity and eternity, where birth and death are all a unity. There is no separation between them. In fact, birth and death are a unity right through our own organic life. I explained this some time ago, you may remember. Because the very process of physical and psychical and psychological growth means that you have died to the previous state in which you were and are reborn in the new state. It's really simple when you grasp this. So, this writer of the Upanishad goes to the Lord of Death and he says to him, "This doubt that there is in regard to a man deceased. He exists, say some. He exists not, say others. This would I know, instructed by thee." The Lord of Death says that this is a question which not only humans but the gods themselves ask, and they don't know the answer. And it is extremely difficult to give it to you. Ask any other boon you like. He offers him wealth and women and everything possible that this earth has. And Nachiketas answers, "What use is all this to me with you in sight?" Knowing that everything that is born, everyone that is born dies, everything that comes into being passes out of being. That boy Nachiketas must have been quite an extraordinary person. And then death, the Lord of Death, says to him, "You are a fit vessel to hear the supreme truth." And he discourses upon Brahman, the Atma, becoming completely free, and also complete freedom from passion and fear from death. Now, what does it mean to go to the house of death and be taught by death? In that silent aloneness of the supreme communion, there is the cessation of all discriminative consciousness. Because our ordinary, everyday, organic consciousness is a discriminative one. It is analytic. It is separative. It is isolative. That is the consciousness we have. You and I see each other as, see one another as somebody different. That is how the senses and the brain interpret the act of seeing through the eyes. Everything is separate from me, different from me. And it's the same in relation to human beings. In actual fact, the entire universe and all that is contained in it is interrelated and interactive. There is no separation. Consider, for example, our own physical body. We are conscious of it as a whole, my body. We know intellectually, because of our knowledge through anatomy and physiology and all the rest of it, that there are different parts of the body. But we also know scientifically that all these innumerable different parts are interrelated, they are interactive, and the body is a single unitary whole that we know. But we don't know it with respect to the rest of the universe outside our own skin. Now, this is the great state of consciousness towards which all mankind is evolving very, very slowly. Unfortunately, so slowly and so quickly in all those respects which bring about conflict and discord, that we have endless misery and suffering. But in that supreme communion, you are clearly conscious of this interaction, this interrelationship. It is not merely a thought, merely an idea, or even just an insight. It is an actual state of consciousness. You see, this actual state of consciousness is the real determining factor of all our thinking, feeling, speaking, and doing. And all our thinking, feeling, speaking, and doing affects our own personal consciousness. As I said, our personal consciousness is isolative and separative. It is dualistic, you see, at least dualistic. One could easily say multiplistic. But through living the religious life, the purification of the psyche takes place, which enables us to transcend all intellectualized perception. When you transcend intellectualized perception, then you become holistically conscious. You are conscious in terms of the unitary whole, the totality as it is. Now, this is the extraordinary thing that man has to realize, each individual man can realize this. Of course, one may say, good Lord, how long will it take? Let us not try to measure it in years. We can't do it. It will take countless millions of years. Professor Turner of Princeton University was once asked to write an essay which was a timetable for eternity, meaning a timetable for the procedure of the universe and how long it would take and so on. Those of you who were present at one of our group summer schools may remember I spoke about this in detail. Well, now, he put down the length of the universe as 10 to the power 1,000 to 2,000 years. But that is only the time taken for the whole of the universe to become an black hole, as we call it, meaning that matter is so condensed, becomes so compact, so tightened up, that no light can escape from it. The gravitational force inside that black hole, and science knows a great deal about black holes throughout our universe, is so great that it can never be seen, because whatever happens, the light rays from that are all drawn back, all the photons are drawn back into the black hole. And so it's an invisible place, as far as we are concerned. Now, even so, there is a quantum process going on in that black hole by which there is a trickling of radiation going outside from the black hole. They call that process a process of tunneling. I don't know what that means really. I only remember the word. It's called a tunneling process. And the time taken for that process to go to complete itself, these scientists say, requires one with 77 zeros after it in years for it to, and the final hiss with which the universe goes into utter silence and eternity is that period of time. Well, we better stick to our calendars and not bother about that process of time. Now, in holistic consciousness, a living man, the perfected Holy One, can be clearly conscious, in depth, in completeness, of all this sort of thing. That is why followers of the religious teachers said that their teacher was omniscient. He knew everything. He did not know everything in the manner and in the sense in which you and I know with our brains. Is that Jerome?
Yes.
with our brains. Because it is not of the nature of an encyclopedic knowledge. It is of the nature of being conscious in the manner and at the place and in the time which you yourself can will. You know, the theologies of the world have always presented God as omnipotent to start with, and therefore the power to create, omniscient, and therefore all-knowing, and omnipresent. Now, how many people in the world behave as if they really knew that God was omnipresent, looking at us now, pleading with us to come home, so to say? very few. But this is the kind of consciousness which the perfected Holy One can have. It's no use, that consciousness is not used in order to find out material facts and things about stars and planets and this, that and the other. It is not applicable to our ordinary, everyday material world. So now, Nachiketas asks the Lord of Death to reveal that supreme teaching. And Yamaraja, the Lord of Death, teaches him yoga. Not yoga as we hear today, know it and talk about it, or even in those Upanishads which deal with yoga as such. This is a transcendent yoga, for which our yoga in the real way is a preparation. So that Nachiketas realizes Brahman in clear consciousness and becomes free of death, not merely the fear of death, but actual death. That is to say, not the death of the organism, because that must necessarily die. It would be tragic if organisms never died and went on doddering for thousands of years. All speech and thought, all particular and limited mental activity is in repose, in perfect quiet, what I have called in this book that vibrant quiescence which belongs to the transcendent. And there is a suspension of the mortal mode of consciousness. But whoever enters that state of consciousness must of necessity come back to ordinary consciousness, otherwise the organism will perish, because the organism must eat, drink, eliminate, exercise, and do all the necessary things which take place in our ordinary organic life. But as and when he wishes, he can enter that supreme state. Now this is where Christian mysticism has differed from Eastern teaching and practice. Saint Teresa, for instance, says quite distinctly that such a state is granted by the grace of God, and you cannot enter it at will or as you wish. The Buddha said very clearly and without any sort of qualification that he and his great disciples could enter that state as and when they wished, for as long as they wished. But of course there is a qualification to the as long as, because they knew, just as we know scientifically nowadays, you mustn't be in that state for more than 7 days continuously. Because if you do that, you upset the protein metabolism to such an extent that you ruin the body. So don't, if any of you enters that transcendent state, remember to have somebody to wake you up on the seventh day. In this enstasy, note, I say enstasy, not ecstasy, because an ecstasy is being beside yourself. You are out of control of yourself. Then you are in an ecstasy. Even whiskey can do that for you. But an enstasy is an entering within into the supreme silence. That stillness and silence is an order, transcendent order, is the beginning of all things. Science, of course, has only got to the stage where it presents the beginning of the material universe as a state of chaos. That's exactly what it is. The Big Bang produced a tremendous chaos, and within 10 to the power minus 23 of a second, 1 divided by 1 with 23 noughts after it. You see, within that period of time, the positively charged and the negatively charged subatomic particles rushed together and generated quantities of energy, which ultimately became our universe. When they first rushed together like that, they destroyed themselves. They got annihilated, but they were converted into two photons. If a positron and an electron banged together, then they created two photons. And a photon is the unit of electromagnetic energy. It is the unit of light, for the photon. The rays of light are streams of photons. In this ecstasy, which is neither a trance nor a state of ecstasy, I mention trance here because so many Western scholars have talked of these deep states of consciousness as entering into trances. They are not trances. You are not entranced. And as a matter of fact, in the Buddha's teachings, you find him teaching his disciples, when you observe anything, observe accurately and perfectly quietly everything in detail, but don't get entranced by it. You see, because that entranced state shuts out the possibility of entering into holistic consciousness. In this state, the Holy One has died to the known world, our ordinary everyday world, organic world as we experience it and are conscious of it. Alive, he knows death. He himself is now the Lord of death. As far as I'm aware, no one has ever explained it this way. I doubt if anyone has seen it that way, excepting perhaps the perfected holy ones themselves when they entered that state. He himself is now the Lord of death. Then there is manifest on earth the realization of the immeasurable unknown, which remains the unknowable in our ordinary sense of the word knowable, our intellectual sense of the word. That supreme origin is the blessed unknowable, the nameless one. I use that phrase in this book, and Krishnamurti in his last 2 years or so has used that same phrase, nameless one. It's not original to me, because in that lovely operetta, The Immortal Hour, that term occurs, the nameless one. The unknown, the unborn, undying, fearless, sorrowless Atma. Afterwards, the teaching given by the Holy One is the fruit of this communion known as the dialogue with death. Now, this death is not like our organic death, of course. It is a state of consciousness. And it is a state which is also a source energy for creation. And creation, in its ultimate reality, its supreme reality is love, where there is no attachment, no feeling, no possessiveness, no being enraptured as we get enraptured by the person we love, and so on and so on. Nothing of that sort. This transcendent love, it's practically impossible to put it in words, but it is there. I have tried in this last book of mine to give some sort of shadow picture of what it is like. But of course, all words are futile ultimately. They are nugatory. But death the teacher is death the other life. Consummator and perfecter. It is, as the Christian mystics have said, the divine dark, the abyss, which is the firm ground out of which streams all creation by the action of the beyond knowing. How then shall Death Lord answer the question of Nachiketas? Even the gods had doubts as to this. Choose another question, and Nachiketas remains firm, and finally the Lord of Death reveals the truth. But of course, the words of the Upanishad do not reveal the truth. Out of the abyss, death the other life, or I would prefer nowadays to say the new life, points his finger to his twin. The pointing is the way. Life, the answer, is the invisible unknown, omnipresent, eternal life. Give me your worldliness, die to your selfness, says death, and my immortal twin will suffuse you with transcendence here now. This is yoga. We must go on to the chapter on the Gita. Krishna, Lord of Yoga, he was called Yogeshwara, proclaims to Arjuna, his disciple, I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal and imperishable, and of eternal truth, and of pure happiness. Now notice, here is, as presented in the books, here is a person saying, I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal and imperishable. No wonder some scholars feel that these old Indian sages were confoundedly conceited. But Krishna also says, puts it the other way about, that Brahman is the source, and so on. Now, I was meditating on this. This is years ago, in the early 1970s, when I wrote this. Who is Krishna? Who is Arjuna? And whose gift is the Bhagavad Gita? He who writes scripture is no reporter, nor versifier, nor professional theologian. Do remember that. Put aside all the theologies. Study the mysticisms if you like. to study. But remember that only when you look within and see truth, that is your truth. And the form in which it comes is your particular form, proclaiming your unique transcendence. That's how it is. He is author, author with a capital A, one who affirms realized transcendence. The name of the person in the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna Dvaipayana Vedavyasa. Krishna means the dark one. He came from the western part of India, they say, belonged to the clan of the Vrishnis. Dvaipayana means island born on an island. Vedavyasa. Vyasa means a compiler. Veda means knowledge. In this case, the transcendent knowledge of the Supreme. Religious knowledge in the Supreme sense. That was his name. The composer of the Gita revealed in his poem the realization of transcendence in his own being. The song of the goal, the way and the fulfillment is couched in the form of the divine dialogue between the warrior prince Arjuna and his charioteer Krishna of the race of Yadu. Krishna worshipped through the centuries as the manifestation of Vishnu, the second person of the Trinity, himself. Now, I think the Hindu world as a whole believes Krishna was a particular person, and Arjuna was one of the five Pandu, the sons of Pandu, who were the princes. But I say no. The writer of the Bhagavad Gita was like some of those writers and teachers, rather, of the Old Testament, people who, having realized transcendence, expressed the teaching given by their transcendent consciousness to the ordinary, everyday, organic consciousness in terms of a divine dialogue. The Lord spoke. And the Lord spoke and said. In the Old Testament you find the angel of the Lord appeared and so on. There is no wing flapping angel of the Lord coming along like a bird or whatever it is. It is your own state of consciousness. This innermost consciousness makes an impress upon the psychophysical organism of such a nature that later on thought and the appropriate words expressing that thought come into being. That is how these great religious teachings were given. Mind you, there have been dozens of such teachers, but the world knows only half a dozen or more, the founders of the religions particularly, and several others. Now, you may say, any critic would certainly say to me, what evidence have you for saying such things? Well, I'll give you the evidence in the words of put in the mouth of Krishna himself. Vedavyasa, as the living man in the world, is himself Arjuna, in the state of supreme consciousness, as the purified Holy One, in whom was manifest realized transcendence, he is Krishna. Now, in the Gita, he himself says, of the children of Vrishni, the clan, I am Krishna. Of the sons of Pandu, I am Arjuna. amongst seers in silence, the Munis. A Muni is the perfected Holy One who is in the state of that silence. I am Vyasa. Among poets, because he was able to give it in poetic terms, I am Ushana. Ushana belongs to the Rig Vedic period, not to this period. And Pandu, the son of Pandu, Arjuna, was supposed to be a prince, a living prince. But Krishna says to him, I am Arjuna, I am Ushana, and so forth. What can it mean? You see, that is why, to me, this is the great evidence that it is the writer of the Gita who, in that state of consciousness, which is the transcendent state, as Krishna, gives the teaching. And the teaching is not given to any other person, it's given to him himself. It emanates out of him. Now be careful how you say this to anybody, because he will say, naturally, oh, these people are crazy. Not crazy. This is the simple fact, I'm sure. This is how, even in ordinary people like ourselves, the deep insights emerge. The deep insights. It suddenly comes. I have talked of the context of infinity and eternity as being the context of transcendence, of holistic consciousness. That just came to me like that in 1978 and 9, those 2 years. So, of course, this was written before that, long before, in the early 1970s. This song of the Lord is called an Upanishad. In those Upanishads, cast in the form of the divine dialogue, the answer is usually ascribed to one or other person of the Trinity. In the Gita, it is given by Krishna, God in His wholeness beyond human compassing. In the Katha Upanishad, the transcendent truth is voiced by the Lord of Death. You yourself, I myself, am the Lord of Death. You yourself, I myself, am God the Justicier, the Lord of Karma. Because in the human kingdom, in this, the microcosm, is embodied all that pertains to the transcendent realm. The whole process of human evolution is directed towards the awakening in the living psychophysical organism of the clear consciousness of that transcendence in fullness. You know that statement by Jesus, no man cometh unto the Father except through me. But exactly what is this me? It is Jesus, the son of Joseph and Mary, who, entering that transcendent consciousness, is in the state which enabled him to say, I and the Father are one. You see, if we can really grasp these things, really see them, the whole struggle between conceit and humility disappears. One knows that as transcendence manifested as a particular thing or person has to be humble. Humble not in the sense of humiliated. It is nothing to do with humiliation. Humility is an extraordinary virtue. Really, humility cannot be described. You can't define it. It is there, and you know it is there. And because in that state of true humility, you are capable of the true adoration and worship of God, of transcendence, of Brahman, whatever you like to call it. You see what the potentiality of man is, the human. Perhaps you begin to see why I have defined the word human as the blissful creator. Well, I think I better stop there now.